Hello and welcome to this Vocalise podcast. I'm Toby Davey, Deputy Director for Vocalise, and in this podcast you'll hear an extended interview with partially sighted British contemporary artist Jonathan Huxley. Many sighted people wouldn't think that a career as an artist would be a good idea for somebody who is blind or partially sighted. But they only have to look at the work of Picasso or Monet, who both continued as artists when their sight started to deteriorate. And in fact, Monet's Water Lilies was painted when his sight had almost gone. There are many blind and partially sighted people who are making a successful career out of working in the arts, whether that's as an artist, painter, musician, writer, actor, etc. Jonathan Huxley is one such successful British contemporary artist who is partially sighted. He has worked in many forms, including painting, ultraviolet light installations, filmmaking and education. And he was the first student from his school to go to art college. When I met Jonathan in his studio in South East London, I first asked him how he would describe himself as an artist.
I'm a painter. I had this conversation with a cab driver in London once, and he said, "What do you do?" And I said, "I'm a painter." And he said, "What? Walls?" And I said, "No, artist." And he said, "Well, why didn't you say you're an artist then? Don't try and patronise me. I know what an artist is." And I said, "Well, because I studied 7 years. I did a foundation, I did a degree at Nottingham, I did 3 years at the Royal Academy of Art diploma, and it was all painting. It was an apprenticeship in paint and painting." The watercolour thing is slightly prominent now because got elected to the Royal Watercolour Society 2 years ago, but it's another form of painting. Filmmaker, Toby, I like that, but it's probably a bit strong. I've made a couple of videos of installations that I've done that were drawn installations using ultraviolet light, but I am essentially a painter.
So what made you want to become an artist, and were you inspired by any other artist or inspired by anybody's work, or did anybody encourage you to become an artist?
Do you know what? For the first, I would say, 16 years of my life, absolutely nobody encouraged me to become an artist whatsoever. In fact, mostly to the contrary. I started painting, like a lot of artists, I think, about 5 years old. And there's a serious note to how that began. I'm not unusual now, but the childhood was not the happiest place. There was death in the family, there was divorce, there was broken homes, and I was in a mainstream school that I wasn't very happy with at all. And so, basically, my art became a retreat. I spent a lot of time in my room drawing and painting a world that I felt happy in and that I could control, if you like. And that became more and more of an obsession as I thought, you know, this is something I love doing. But going through school, I was not given accolades or any prizes or anything like that. I just sort of drifted along, but building more and more of a conviction that this was something that I really wanted to do. And then got to school with you. And the art teacher there, one Mr. Bob Stanier, after me rattling on his door and not, you know, burdening him with my presence any time I could, said to me, quite famously, he said, "Huxley, you're not driving a Ferrari, but you've got the petrol." So I then applied to art school, and I was the first person in our school to apply to art school. I don't know if you know that.
No, I didn't know that.
I was. We were going into the void. We had no idea how it was done or anything like that. And anyway, long and short, I did an interview and ended up at Berkshire College of Art and Design to do a foundation. Carried on, did a degree at Trent Poly, still not really knowing what I was doing or why I was doing it. So probably luckily for me, I went for the safest route and spent my 3 years at Nottingham drawing from the life model, going outside, drawing the landscape, drawing the town, drawing people. I would go to bars and draw jazz bands, always observational work, for a good solid 2.5 years of my degree. It was all very worthy and a very good grounding, but nothing really to shine, no big ideas, no concepts. Then, of course, the end of your degree comes and you think, what am I going to do? You've had your fun. You've done a bit of, you know, art school and nothing's really come out of it much. Nobody's, you know, singing your praises. You haven't won any prizes. So I went and applied to do teacher training at Cardiff. So I could actually be now sitting in a very comfortable house in South Wales, running an art department of a school. And then there was this pivotal moment. There always is, isn't there? There's a moment when something happens which changes your direction. What happened was there was a tutor from the Royal Academy of Art called Michael Upton. Brilliant artist, great friend, sadly died a few years ago. And he came down, and that day I had been told a story by a friend of mine, interestingly enough, from South Wales, another painter called Nick Comerford. And he'd come in and he'd seen this story of something had happened outside the college at a major crossroads. A meat van had jumped a red light, buzzed around the corner, breaking the speed limit, and carried on up the road. But the doors had flown open and all this meat had fallen out onto the street, big sides of beef and whole bits of pig, you know. And he said, you wouldn't believe it. The guy just drove off not knowing what had happened. And it took seconds for people to stop their cars, run off the pavement, grab up these lumps of meat, stash it in cases, you know, bags, boots of cars, and drive off with them, you know. And I thought, that's crazy. The guy was probably on his way to the glue factory. You know, this stuff is probably going to be rotten. You could have had unreportable cases of food poisoning all over the Nottingham area. Anyway, I used to do little cartoons on the quiet. So I made a cartoon of this incident, and it was from an aerial perspective over the crossroads. So it looked very sort of religious, and it was called Knock Off. It was a bit of a parable thing. Anyway, this guy from the Royal Academy comes in, and he said, looked at all my 2 years worth of worthy life drawings, all in dark charcoal, and then saw this cartoon that I'd thrown on the floor in the corner of the studio, and he said, what's that? And I told him the story, and he said, you know what, that is about as interesting as all this is dull. He said, make a painting about that. I said, well, I've never made a painting about anything. I just do drawings. He said, make a painting about that. I'm back in 3 weeks' time. So I found in the corridor of the college a 6-foot by 6-foot canvas, rather like the one you've just seen down there. And I went to work and I couldn't put a foot wrong or a brush wrong. It was amazing. In fact, Leicester Council now own that painting. And he came back 3 weeks later and goes, there you go. All you got to do is now two more of those and you can stick in an application to the Royal Academy of Art. It cost you 15 quid. What have you got to lose? Oh, but I'm going to be a teacher in Wales. Yeah. So what do? I do two more paintings and take them down there. And there he is, Michael Upton, in the interview panel. I'm thinking, this is great. Plain sailing. There he is, my mate. And the interview went fine for the first half an hour. And then Michael Upton says to me, Jonathan, where do you place yourself on the scale of social realism? Now, with the benefit of 30 years hindsight, I'd go at the top, mate. But I just went, literally, they were dragging me out. It was like, you know, it's over for you, son. And I was like, he set me up. And I go back to Nottingham thinking it's all done. And I get a letter in the post saying, sorry, Mr. Huxley, on this occasion, we can't offer you a place at the Royal Academy of Art. Now, the application is 50, but we'll put you on the reserve list. They will put you on the reserve list. 1,500 kids apply, 12 people get picked, reserve list. So I just think, well, this is rubbish, you know. And then 3 days later, the phone rings and I get given a place at the Royal Academy. And that was it. And suddenly I had this confidence that had come out of one painting, this turning point from just, you know, having some sort of idea that this was my thing to actually going, bang, I was doing these paintings and I couldn't stop.
And does the sort of, you know, the world around you drive your art? Does, you know, what you see, does that drive your art?
I'm a figurative artist, so my work is, I suppose, loosely based on what you might call the human condition. The work I do has got very, very different facets. I mean, there's the day job, which are these multi-figured paintings, which I like to call figurescapes, which are almost abstract in their construction. They involve 500, 1,000 images, crowd scenes viewed from above. Those are sort of just more about paint and painting, whereas the watercolours, the small pictures, they're like sort of, I don't know, like little fairy tales, little fictional stories that I make up, things that appear. I use the figure because I understand it, probably having drawn it, as I said, for years. I use the figure by default because there's nothing more potent than the human figure, really, in terms of a visual image. But the rest of it is about magic and bedazzlement and making something that just looks juicy and beautiful. I think that's really overlooked in painting these days, because what you're doing is magic. It's a trick. One of the reasons I was never responsive to sculpture is it's too honest. You have a piece of sculpture which you can walk around. It exists in its own space. It's tangible. Whereas a painting, well, it's a flat surface, isn't it? You know, you're trying to convince somebody to walk into something which they plainly can't do. You're creating an illusion, a trick. It's all smoke and mirrors. So it's about making something that enthralls and confuses and makes people like, wow, how did he do that?
You have an eye condition. I mean, it's not as bad as mine. You don't need a guide dog. You don't need a white stick. Do you feel in any way that your eyesight has affected your work in any way, or in sort of made your work, or is it sort of completely, you know, sort of unrelated?
No, of course it's related. Anybody's eyesight is related, and it certainly has. If you're asking me to give you an analysis of how it's affected the work, that would be really difficult. I mean, I know that I wear glasses now when I'm looking at you. I've got fairly strong distance glasses, and I make a point of not wearing them in the studio because one thing I do find is that I can say I'm working on a painting that's 2 by 3 meters. I can get a much better view of the overall effect if I don't have the glasses on. I get a much sort of, I don't get obsessed with the details, the little bits and pieces, and I do tend to work in details. I work from a very close up, very close up, sometimes using a magnifying glass on drawings to going back and getting a nice blurred overall look of something. But in terms of how it's affected the work, I think I've dealt with it really quite pragmatically. For example, being at the Royal Academy, when I arrived at the studios there and they hadn't changed for years, the fluorescent light bulbs were kind of yellow, you know. And I remember just saying, I can't work with these, you know. I mean, albinism is a weird thing because you're apparently photophobic, sensitive to light, but in some conditions, you need brighter light. It's never an exact science. So, anyway, I said, can we have some daylight light bulbs in here? And they generously provided the daylight light bulbs. But of course, within a week, everybody at the Royal Academy wanted daylight light bulbs because suddenly, you know, their studios appeared to be like they were painting in custard compared to mine, which was bright and white and beautiful. So, I pretty much single-handedly just changed the whole light rig at the Royal Academy by my access requirement, which is quite simple. I probably conceptualise my work. You know, I said that it's not really observational anymore. I don't go out and sit out and paint out of my window what I can see because a lot of it I can't really see, and I'm not interested. It's just interested in being an impressionist. So I internalise and conceptualise the real world, and it comes out in a much more fantastical way. For example, in a lot of my pictures, there you will get big figures and little figures for no apparent reason, and you'll get random objects that butt up against each other, and there's no, it's almost like things are just floating in an infinite space. So I dispense with horizons, I dispense with perspective. Those I find limitations that I could do without, really, and that may well be a consequence of it. I don't know.
You know, you don't make a big thing about your eye condition. Your art speaks more than you, doesn't it?
You mean, do I address it in my art?
I suppose so, because there is that thing about being blind has a label to it, and you know, some people use that label, some people don't, and you know, and then some people want to get recognised for their work rather than, you know, sort of having something else labelling them.
I have to say, if I'm honest about it, I was very, very shy about getting involved in anything that had a reference, even like this, for example, this interview. 20 years ago, I'd have said, well, what do they want? You know, how's this going to make me appear? You know, I'm a young artist. I want to exist in my own right. I don't want to be pushed up the ladder by having by being in a minority sport, you know. So I guess now I've been professional now for over 20 odd years. And I think, you know, if there's a really good reason for it, then I'm very happy to engage in discuss and having a dialogue about vision and art. But it's never something I ever try to address in my work. I'm not interested in the politics of it. I don't feel like I'm marginalised. So, but I think I certainly don't dismiss the idea of that, and people who do, I think it's important. There are aspects of, you know, inclusiveness and disability that need to be seriously addressed, and why not do it in the art vernacular?
From what you were saying earlier on, going to Royal Academy was obviously a big milestone in your career as an artist. Are there any other milestones that stand out for you?
He put me on the spot now. Milestones. Probably leaving the Royal Academy, actually. That was probably the biggest, because you know, the Royal Academy was a really good education. It really was an apprenticeship. I mean, I very rigorous life drawing, compulsory for the first year, and I hasten to add, it's a 3-year diploma, not just a 2-year. Most fine art MAs are only 1 or 2 years. The Royal Academy is 3 years. So the middle year, you get to mess about, you get to really experiment. First year, you had to be in the life room drawing from the model 2 days a week. We had anatomy classes. We had slightly pretentiously called chemistry classes, which is learning about drying times of paint and how to mix things and various techniques. So it was rigorous composition, you know. So leaving the Royal Academy, I felt incredibly free to then break all those rules and have my own studio, move to South East London, set up with a cooperative, the Lewisham Art House then as it was. I mean, the thing about the Royal Academy, that anybody who got in there kind of did have an invisible top hat and cape and swashbuckled down the corridor like that. I had some sort of, it was like being given a peerage, you know. It was like you had this, you made it. So to come back to South East London and then just be with normal artists, let's say, can't find a better word, and then get involved in projects, education, all sorts of stuff. You know, that was great. Build our own studios, you know, make a mess. So that was really liberating, leaving art education. And that's when I really started to go, because I ended up doing all sorts of stuff. You know, I ended up doing ultraviolet art in nightclubs in New York. Yeah. That, I mean, I left the academy in 92. By 1995, I was doing Grace Jones's birthday party at the Tunnel Club in New York. There were no classes in ultraviolet painting at the Royal Academy. I don't know how that happened, but, you know, I just sort of, boom, I was gone. I was away.
Talking about being commissioned to Grace Jones's birthday party and and then the Met Bar and Channel 4 and, you know, working at Glyndebourne and the Welcome Collection and stuff. Having been commissioned or working somewhere, does that sort of inspire the work that you're producing, or is it sort of quite separate, the work rather than the actual place where you're working or the person you're being commissioned by?
The Welcome Collection stands out. That was a really inspirational project. I do an event called the Big Ultraviolet Mobile Project, which is basically I rig up ultraviolet lights, and it's a drop-in installation building thing where everybody gets to build a mobile, simple materials, paper card, UV drawing tools. But being at the Welcome Collection, and everything that was there had to be to do with science of one aspect or another. So I set up the Big Ultraviolet Mobile Project, but they gave me access to all their archive of electron microscope photographs of viruses, bacteria, organisms, diseases, which are often infused with fluorescent dyes, so you can see them. So, for example, athlete's foot under a microscope looks beautiful. It's like a crystal. I mean, HIV, terrible disease. Under a microscope, it looks stunning, like a planet. It's like something from another solar system. Sickle cell, you know, everything. Incredible forms to see, but yet deadly and undesirable. So we called the project Deadly Pretty Things, and everybody was invited to come in and interpret these images in ultraviolet light and graphic materials and hang them up. So it became, over the course of about 4 days, like an interbody experience. Black room with these floating images, and we had hematologists coming up from their own departments, spending a couple of hours drawing DNA double helixes and stuff like this. It was amazing stuff. So I was, you know, obviously just looking at a form of medical specimens that I've never really seen before, never paid any attention to, and seeing how other people interpreted this and realising that actually you could make a work of art by not actually touching anything in that sort of Jeremy Deller way. You know, I don't do anything. I just sort of manage it, you know, and it was an amazing project. It's online, actually. You can have a look at that.
You were recently elected Associate of the Royal Watercolour Society. Was this a sort of a good accolade for you and moment in your career?
Of course it is. I mean, a very respectable organisation, let it be said. And I'm only an associate, so I have to put the work in if I want to become a bona fide member of the Royal Watercolour Society. So I'm ARWS. Basically, I won a prize in the Sunday Times Watercolour Award, and the president of the RWS was giving out the gongs and said, "Do you fancy having a bash at it? So what are you going to do?" So I'm now in officially in hock to the Queen, because I haven't paid my subs this year.
You should send round the bailiffs. So
quite like that bit.
Looking back at all the work you've done so far, and you know, and obviously, you know, thinking about the work that you're doing at the moment, which areas of your work give you the most pleasure? Is it the painting? Is it the educational stuff that you've done? Is it the commissions?
Pleasure. There's a funny word, eh? Probably
most satisfaction. Perhaps.
Most satisfaction, I would say, definitely in my recent introduction into education, working with multiple different groups through the Royal Academy of Arts. I'm an artist educator there now, so I get to work with groups from crisis, adults with terminal illnesses, to young people with all sorts of levels of learning difficulties, blind, deaf, everybody, we're all there. I get to formulate the projects and run them, and that's brilliant. I really, really, really like that. It's nice to get out of the ivory tower of this studio, because it can be not isolating. I don't mind what people say, oh, you do not get lonely working in a studio. That doesn't bother me, because as you can probably tell by nature, I'm quite garrulous, and as soon as I get out, I'm not shy to talk to people. But there is something about working with others and seeing the potential that particularly young people, artists have to do things that will constantly surprise and amaze. And that's brilliant. And also working at the Royal Academy, the exhibitions change every 3 months, so we have to know about those exhibitions, then apply them, and then, you know, devise workshops around those. And it's not a huge amount of work. I'm only there, you know, once every twice, three times a month, but that's really stimulating work. And it's the first time I've probably bothered to actually read art catalogues for the first time in my career. So I'm brushing up on my art history at the same time.
And, you know, obviously you've had exhibitions around the world, all over the place, you know, Japan, Miami, Paris. You know, you've been commissioned by all these wonderful people and stuff. And you have representation by not only a gallery here in London, but one in Paris as well. Do you feel that you sort of got the recognition and you sort of made it as an artist?
No. Give me more recognition. I want more. I'm won the Turner Prize.
What's next?
Yeah. I think I've realised after, yeah, since, you know, the Royal Academy, 1992, leaving college, that I am the sort of artist who really loves making art. But to get further recognition, you may be referring to, say, for example, the positions of the likes of Damien Hirst, Tracy and Emin, you know, the young British artists. You mentioned that my my website, if you look it up, says young. Does it say British? Young? Does it say, doesn't say young?
I'm
no.
Not, I'm just British. Sure that young.
Contemporary British artists, that's right. You know, they're like all creative professions, I think there's a level that you have to gear up to if you really want the accolades, you know, if you want. I've never been one to schmooze around the private view circuits, for example. I don't go to First Thursdays in the East End. I don't go around all the galleries. I don't send letters to curators, and I don't invite critics to come and look at my work. I probably should. Maybe I should. I don't know. I'm not really interested in that. I am very interested in the production of the work, and nothing leaves this studio unless, as I said, it bejewels and bedazzles and it's got magic and it works. That may change. I may, you know, I may sort of get a bit more long in the tooth and say, I don't want to keep coming to this cold studio in Deptford. I want to live in a slightly more salubrious fashion. And I might start writing to those critics, but I doubt it. So, you know, all I wanted really was to make the art. So I suppose in that respect, then I've got somewhere.
A lot of people would say, you know, people who are sighted have this opinion that somebody who's blind or partially sighted shouldn't get involved in the arts because it's in a, you know, it's a visual form and everything else. And obviously something that we can actually broadcast on Insight Radio. But what would you say to those people who have that opinion?
I will tell you a story about when I was... we have to go back to school for this one. We used to have these meetings with careers officers, and it's a careers officer's duty to send you into a career that's probably respectable and secure, whatever that means now. I don't know what they are. But that's what happened to me. And when I said I wanted to go to art school and be an artist, of course they said, you can't do that. That's not a living. How about graphic design? How about cartography? Map making? And even then, you know, I was old enough and intelligent enough to say to them, look, have you seen my eyes? Do you know what they're like? Do you know how long it would take me to draw a map or to work in a graphic office in a computer? Forget about it. The one thing about contemporary art world is that nobody's going to know. Nobody's going to know. Since Marcel Duchamp put a urinal in a gallery in 1930, whatever it was, and called it a work of art, he wrote off all that. The French Salon collapsed. There was no longer a standard. Yes, of course, if I'd been born in 15th century and everything was being made for the church and there was a standard of drawing, standard making, then possibly I wouldn't have been able to do this. But given the gift that Duchamp gave us, when he shattered all that, and it's not... Now it's about how individual you can be. I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but how could anybody possibly tell when you look at a contemporary work of art, whether that person's got an eye condition or not? You can't. It's probably the best profession for anybody partially sighted to exist on their own terms.
I suppose following on from that answer, what would you say to somebody who's blind or partially sighted? You might be listening to this and thinking, oh, you know, I want to become an artist, or I want to go and see some great art. You know, what should they go out there and do it?
No, there's too many of us on the food chain. Tell them to go and get a proper job. What you think? Of course, of course. It's, go out and grab it with both hands. Yeah. If anybody gets in your way, give them a kick. Do it.
What's next for you? What's next? What do you want to do next?
Do you know what? I've never had any ambition in that respect, Tony. I've never had a life plan. I've never. You know, I've got friends who say, you know, I want to do this. I've got a 5-year plan. You know, this happened to a friend of mine recently. You know, he did this 5-year plan, and then he got ill. You know, he got quite seriously ill, and suddenly everything went up in smoke. And then he got better, and sat down with him, and he said, "I've got this plan." I said, "Hold on, you had a plan 2 years ago, and you know things get in the way. You never know what's going to happen." I've never been one. You know, he's just written that book, Danny Baker. Brilliant title. I went to sea in a sieve. That's how I feel about how I run my life. You know, everything has happened kind of serendipitously, by coincidence or juxtaposition of being in the right place at the right time. But I've never had a plan, so I really don't know.
To find out more about Jonathan and to view examples of his work online, do visit his website at www.jonathanhuxley.com. To find out more about Vocalize audio described performances, the availability of description in museums, galleries and heritage sites, do visit our website at www.vocalize.co.uk. Vocalize is a charity funded by Arts Council England. And this podcast has been produced by Toby Davey.